This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight.
They're coming just wearing trainers, light trousers. Some of them have just got sort of wind cheaters on. They just don't realize it's so cold up there. They're taking shelter in mountain cabins. Locals are opening their doors to try and help these people. They just really want to get to France.
That's reporter Catherine Field in Paris. Migrants are continuing to make the journey across the French Alps in freezing temperatures. We'll have full details coming up. Also, Cameroon Christian and Muslim religious leaders call for peace and dialogue to end the crisis in the English-speaking regions of the nation. And the UN Refugee Agency begins a mass voluntary repatriation of Sudanese refugees in the Central African Republic to the homes they fled a decade ago. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. A former spokesman of Zimbabwe's ousted president said Robert Mugabe is in Singapore for a medical checkup. Mugabe was spotted leaving a Singapore medical facility today. The 93-year-old Mugabe had not been seen in public since his resignation after last month's military takeover that ended his 37-year reign. He has been in increasingly frail health and has reportedly battled prostate cancer. Cameroon Christian and Muslim religious leaders are calling for peace and dialogue to end the crisis in English-speaking regions of the nation that have led secession calls. The religious leaders say the crisis, if not well handled, will add to the bloodshed from the Boko Haram insurgency in the north and neighboring Central African Republic. Moki Edwin Kenzika reports from Yaoundé.
The St. Anne Choir of Yaoundé's Catholic Cathedral sings for peace to reign in Cameroon at an ecumenical service with all Christian denominations and Muslims. Among the hundreds of priests, pastors, and imams is Sheikh Mohamedou Mokhtar of the Etudi Central Mosque in the Cameroon capital, Yaoundé.
Every one of us must apply the command of the Almighty God to live in peace, in harmony with the other people everywhere we are. And we must be, all of us, without any distinction, ambassadors of peace.
Apostle Paul Keng of the Living Word Fellowship, who spoke for Pentecostal denominations, says his greatest wish is for peace to return to Cameroon in 2018.
All Cameroonians come together on the table and let the peace be in our nation, because nobody can develop a nation when there is war. I'm calling our leaders that are in a position of influence to open their heart to the Lord. Cameroon have a great destiny, and please come to the Lord, and God is more than able to do it. He's going to heal our land. So peace in Cameroon, in Jesus' name.
Cameroon experienced few major challenges since its independence in the 1960s. But within the past several years, it has been enveloped by the bloody Boko Haram insurgency in the north, the spillover of the violence in the Central African Republic, and calls for secession in the English-speaking southern regions. In the English-speaking southwestern towns of Eyumodjock and Mamfe, attacks on military positions escalate by the day. Alain Mokete, a 36-year-old resident of Eyumodjock, says he supports the secessionists. He says he prefers to speak in French so authorities in Yaoundé can get the message that English speakers in the country, where French is also an official language, want to have their independence because they can no longer bear mistreatment by the French majority.
On a décidé que pour le moment,
he says even if they are arrested and locked up, they will continue to press for their independence and have decided never to send their children to school as a sign of total dissatisfaction with injustices they have subdued. He says they have decided that they must separate from French-speaking Cameroon, and when they shall have their independence, they will reorganize their own school year and start everything over again. Schools have been closed in most of English-speaking Cameroon for more than a year. Ernest Bako, a parent of school-aged children, says he is also not tired of keeping his kids at home.
Because of the Anglophone crisis, the government does not want to respond positively.
In early October, the separatists declared the independence of the state they call Ambazonia and claimed Julius Ayuktabe, an information technology executive with the American University of Nigeria, was their president. Cameroon says many separatist fighters were going for training in Nigeria. So far, at least 12 soldiers and policemen have been killed in the two English-speaking regions by the separatist fighters, according to the government. Residents and local newspapers say at least 20 soldiers have been killed. Dozens of the separatists have also been killed, with at least 40 suspects arrested. Cameroon President Paul Biya declared war on the fighters, describing them as terrorists. Last November, UN High Commissioner for Refugees reported that it was working with the Nigerian government and other UN agencies on a contingency plan for humanitarian assistance to thousands of Cameroonians crossing into Nigeria as a result of tensions and fighting between armed separatists and government troops. Nigeria and Cameroon are already in a war with Boko Haram that has created one of the world's worst humanitarian crises, with some 25,000 people killed and some 2.5 million displaced. Cameroon is also grappling with the spillover of crisis in neighboring CAR that has led to sporadic attacks on its territory by armed groups for supplies. The clergy are calling for honest and sincere dialogue between the government and the separatists to stop what they say may be a genocide in the making. But Paul Biya has maintained that he is not open for negotiation with the separatists. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Well, no agreement was reached as European Union and African Union leaders wrapped up a summit today in Paris that included talks on the distribution of migrants throughout EU countries. Germany and Italy argued that all EU countries must participate in taking in migrants, but many countries said they don't have the resources. Meanwhile, migrants continue to attempt the dangerous journey through a French Alpine route in freezing temperatures and without proper clothing. I spoke with reporter Catherine Field in Paris for the latest developments.
Germany and Italy have been saying they've got to be distributed throughout the European Union. There was no agreement on this. The particularly countries in Eastern Europe, Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic, Slovakia have said no, they will not take a quota number. They might take a few, but some of these countries are saying no, they don't have the funds to be able to house these people, give them new jobs, teach them the language. Others have said it's just culturally insensitive to ask them to take in these migrants. Many of them who have come from the Middle East and Africa, they say that they just do not fit in. The fact that Europe as a whole was unable to agree overnight a way ahead of this just shows you that so many countries in Europe have so many different approaches to how to deal with the migrant crisis. And given that, yes, the numbers are down, we've only seen something like 180,000 coming over into Europe this year. So if you compare that to, say, more than a million in 2015, shows that fewer people are coming, the pressure is lessening. But it also shows that if there is a new surge in the new year, for example, if there's more unrest in particularly the Middle East, that Europe still does not have a policy for dealing with all these migrants who are coming and are needing help.
In the meantime, there are migrants now, because we are into the winter months, that are having to really try to survive this cold weather. So can you tell us about some of the situations and the concerns of the migrants?
One of the main concerns, particularly here in France at the moment, is that
As the authorities have sort of closed off border crossings or have more checks on border crossings, the larger routes between particularly France and Italy, that some of the young migrants have taken to coming over the Alps, mountain passes, for example. And this year already, we've seen some 1,600 come across over the Alps, really very much into the north. Now, in the summer, it's a difficult route, particularly you. So it's not so difficult. And in October, for example, on one particular path, some 50 migrants came across in one day. But now we're into winter, and these migrants are still coming over. And we're talking about, in particular, one area of the Alps where residents have just become so disheartened at how authorities are dealing with the migrants that they've taken to having nighttime patrols in the mountains. Now, don't forget, we're talking about minus 10 to minus 15 degrees overnight. The snow there now is sort of chest high, but still we're getting reports of dozens making that journey overnight, just not even dressed for the weather. They're coming just wearing trainers, light trousers. Some of them have just got sort of wind cheaters on. They just don't realize it's so cold up there. They're taking shelter in mountain cabins. Locals are opening their doors to try and help these people. They just really want to get to France. One of the reasons the locals are so concerned there is they know these mountains. They know they've seen these youngsters, a lot of them are unaccompanied minors, having to go to hospital as soon as they arrive because they get frostbite. When the police find these youngsters, they just turn them around and send them back to Italy. That is the problem that they're worried about. And it's really just in the last 24, 48 hours that the local prefect has said, we have to do more because someone is going to die in these mountains.
That was reporter Catherine Field. She spoke with me from Paris. The hybrid court of South Sudan is one step closer to being established on this, the fourth anniversary of South Sudan's conflict. As Ayan Bior reports, officials in South Sudan and the African Union made a major decision on the makeup and expectations of the court.
As a signal of the South Sudan government's commitment to the establishment of the court, the African Union and the Council of Ministers of South Sudan agreed on Wednesday to the contents of a document that defined the roles of the court, according to Elizabeth Deng, a Nairobi-based researcher for Amnesty International.
This is the document that would specify the criminal jurisdiction of the court, that would define the crimes that the court has the competency to investigate and prosecute. The statute would describe the structure and the composition of the court and the appointment procedures for the court staff.
The 2015 peace deal called on the African Union Commission to establish the court to investigate and prosecute individuals accused of violating international or applicable South Sudanese law since conflict erupted in 2013 through the end of the transitional period. Deng says progress has been slow.
Over the past 2 years, you know, the feeling of Amnesty International has been that the government of South Sudan has been a significant factor in delaying the court's establishment. Really, they had been dragging their feet and, you know, being reluctant in terms of their engagement with the African Union to ensure that it is established quickly.
The government and the African Union are due to organize the signing of the document that is expected to usher in the next phase of the legal process. While some efforts have been made on the humanitarian front to end the conflict, Francesco Lanino, Mercy Corps' acting country director for South Sudan, says the international community is not moving fast enough. Lanino writes the humanitarian conditions are deteriorating faster than we thought possible. He says while a lot has happened in South Sudan, nothing has really changed in the last 4 years.
The food insecurity is still here. The hunger is still here. You know, we had also many cases of cholera in South Sudan. Children really are not really attending schools because of the food insecurity. Malnutrition is very high. What is happening in South Sudan? That really the situation is, yes, getting worse every year.
And Lanino says all of this is happening under the neglectful eye of the international community, despite a rare declaration of famine earlier this year. But Lanino says he's not going to give up on South Sudan.
We still need support from donors, international community to keep saving lives in South Sudan. We're not really giving up. to South Sudan. On the other hand, international community should really find ways and support the resuming of the peace talks and help us to reach the most vulnerable people in South Sudan, to really give us safe access to all the different areas, to really facilitate our work.
The regional bloc IGAD has organized a high-level forum in Addis Ababa next week to revitalize the 2015 peace deal. There is renewed hope that the talks, which will include government and opposition members, will put the country back on track towards lasting peace and stability. Ayan Bior for VOA News, Washington.
The UN Refugee Agency has begun a mass voluntary repatriation of Sudanese refugees in the Central African Republic to homes they fled a decade ago in what was then war-torn Darfur. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency says the first group of more than 230 refugees have arrived at Sudan's Niala Airport from their camps in Bambari, Central African Republic. The UNHCR says it plans 66 more chartered flights to bring another 1,300 or so refugees to their homes of origin in Sudan's Darfur region by the end of the year. The refugees are among nearly 3,500 that have lived in Bambari since they fled fighting between Sudanese forces and armed groups in South Darfur. The war in Darfur, which broke out in 2003, has killed tens of thousands and displaced millions of people within and outside the country. Although sporadic fighting and skirmishes continue with different degrees of intensity, the security situation in South Darfur has been steadily improving, persuading many refugees in the CAR to return home. UNHCR spokesman Babar Balosh tells VOA that agency teams have visited the places of origin in Darfur to assess conditions. He says it was deemed safe enough for at least this first group of refugees to return home.
But let's not forget that once they're back, some challenges will still remain. The places are really remote. There's no infrastructure there as well. So we hope to continue working with government and other organizations to improve services and keep a watch on what happens when they go back home.
Despite the dark legacy left by the Darfur conflict, a growing number of refugees and internally displaced people have been returning spontaneously to their homes in the last few years. The UNHCR says this is largely due to improved security, the signed peace agreements between the government and some armed groups, and the presence of the UN African Union hybrid peacekeeping mission in the region. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580, and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. At 23 minutes past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. No agreement was reached as EU and AU leaders wrapped up a summit today in Paris that included talks on the distribution of migrants throughout EU countries. And Cameroon Christian and Muslim religious leaders call for peace and dialogue to end the crisis in English-speaking regions of the nation that have led secession calls. For more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. In 2011, the world watched the Egyptian revolution as hundreds of thousands of Egyptians took to the streets to press for the universal rights they had been denied. Almost 7 years after the revolution, experts detect a rapid deterioration of human rights situations in Egypt. Tom Lantos of the Human Rights Commission invited witnesses to a congressional hearing to assess the situation and to offer some recommendations for the U.S. to get involved. VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi has the story.
Amy Hawthorne, Deputy Director for Research at the Project on Middle East Democracy, recently told members of U.S. Congress that the Egyptian government's actions include cracking down on civil society groups.
The anti-terrorism law defines terrorism in such sweeping terms to include speech, writing, and other peaceful dissent. This law has been used to imprison peaceful activists who have nothing to do with terrorism. The NGO law, which criminalizes many legitimate NGO activities and severely limits domestic and foreign funding, its goal is the elimination of independent civil society in Egypt.
During a recent hearing by the Tom Lantos Human Rights Commission in Congress, Hawthorne called for U.S. engagement to counter Egypt's use of repressive laws.
U.S. officials should press on three pivotal laws in particular, the protest law, the NGO law, and the anti-terrorism law. Each of these laws blocks the exercise of fundamental rights that are essential for a peaceful and tolerant society.
Egypt's government has denied committing abuses. It also says tough measures can be needed as it confronts the threat from Islamic extremists who have claimed responsibility for a number of deadly attacks in the country. Joe Stork is the former deputy director of Human Rights Watch's Middle East and North Africa division. At the hearing, he said that thousands of prisoners languish in Egyptian prisons without charges, access to legal counsel, due process, or proper food and medical care.
Our best conservative estimate is something like at least 67,000 people have been arrested since the military coup in July 2013, including secular and leftist activists, as well as alleged supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Stork warns that laws restricting peaceful protests and criticism and harsh jail terms have created a society of fear in Egypt. In August, President Donald Trump's administration said it would withhold a portion of its foreign aid to Egypt because of a lack of progress on human rights and democracy. Michelle Dunn, senior fellow and director of the Middle East program at Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, says such measures can push to improve human rights in Egypt.
The United States should conduct the bilateral security assistance with Egypt so as to signal that security and human rights are not separate realms, but are deeply connected. And we should also maintain or expand the percentage of security assistance that can be withheld from Egypt based on human rights conditions.
Dunn says human rights abuses hurt the security environment in Egypt by fueling radicalism and terrorism in the country. A spokesperson for Egypt's Ministry of Foreign Affairs accused the Tom Lantos Committee of using the hearing to defame Egypt because only its critics were invited. The spokesperson said the commission denied requests from Egypt's embassy in Washington to ensure a fair discussion by including people with different views. Mohammed Chinawi, VOA News, Washington.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in, you will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis? We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.